How long is now? There is a legend among the more advanced civilizations of the universe, one whispered quietly, passed down through the generations. The story of the Star Whale. A formidable creature that can open its chasmic mouth and swallow solar systems whole in a single gulp. One flick of its mighty fluke can lay waste to entire civilizations. The oldest libraries in the cosmos hold the most ancient of books, all with drawings of this leviathan, pieced together from rumor and hearsay. Its leathery skin is said to be encrusted with barnacles of star stuff, its enormous baleen plates peppered with billions of years' worth of interplanetary plankton. At least, that is billions of years to us. For the star whale travels at as close to the speed of light as it is possible for an object with mass to get. To it, time passes very differently indeed, making our sense of now a nonsense. To the star whale, all 13.8 billion years of the universe's history unfolds in a single quintillionth of a second. The entirety of human history happens in far less, not even noticeable to its senses. Every war, every invention, every lost love, and every laughing child gone in no time at all. And as we'll see as we follow the story of this great creature, the notion of now is not only highly mysterious, but also wildly subjective. And you don't need to be a giant intergalactic whale to have an altered perception of it. A car races down a road towards a flock of pigeons, seemingly oblivious to the oncoming danger. It looks for all the world like the birds will become one with the tarmac, only for them to scatter at the very last moment. Why did they leave it so long? The truth is, they didn't. Our sense of now and theirs is different. Pigeons experience the world at over 100 frames per second, as opposed to the 25 to 30 that films do. It helps them keep track of fast-moving insects, so in the case of the onrushing car, they simply have more time to react to it than it naively seems to you or I. They experience the world in slow motion. And so now can last longer or shorter depending on how you have evolved, what you are doing, and like the star whale in the most extreme cases, how fast you are traveling. Indeed, it is even possible for two people to see a series of nows unfold in a completely different order. Human intuition is no yardstick for the way the universe really works. And so, as we journey with the star whale into the far distant universe, giga annums passing in the blink of an eye, we are left with one big question. What is now? And does it even exist outside of our heads? On Christmas Day 2021, millions of people around the world held their breath as the James Webb Space Telescope finally took off. 6 months later, the images began to be released in incredible detail with unprecedented quality. What does space taste like? Stars swirl in the void at dizzying speeds as the very fabric of time and space is tugged and stretched. We are in the shadow of Sagittarius A star, the monstrous black hole at the heart of our Milky Way galaxy. Just 390 light years away from this dark heart, an astronomical footstep, lies a vast cloud of gas and dust known as Sagittarius B2. It's been the subject of much scrutiny, with astronomers poring over its ancient light in search for clues to what lies within. Among the many ingredients they've found there is a molecule known as ethyl formate. It may sound unfamiliar, but it's the same molecule that gives raspberries their distinctive flavor. And so, this begs the question, what does space taste like? Does the star whale find some celestial snacks more delicious than others? And what about what space smells like? Well, ethyl formate is also responsible for the smell of rum. Then there's the Kickstarter campaign that's raised over $500,000 to manufacture Odor Space, a perfume based on astronauts' accounts of the universe's distinctive odor. Think burnt meat, burnt cakes, spent gunpowder, and the welding of metal. But whatever the star whale's culinary preferences, it's still bound by a nervous system, just like you and I. And the way your senses help you interpret the world around you has important consequences for our notion of now. You sit and watch as a carefully orchestrated ballet unfolds before you. A penguin-suited waiter pulls out a chair for a newly arrived guest as the sommelier buzzes with excitement while discussing the finest Bordeaux in the extensive wine list. The white tablecloths are freshly ironed, the cutlery suitably weighty, and the glassware reassuringly expensive. Shortly afterwards, your first course arrives, a delicate morsel lovingly crafted by a brigade of chefs with an imagination to rival the greatest painters. You take a bite, and your brain floods with endorphins. It's your first taste of Michelin-starred food, and in an instant you see what all the fuss is about. Except that it isn't really an instant at all. When the food hits your tongue, your taste buds register different tastes, such as salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. Those signals travel along your cranial nerves to your brainstem, which then passes them on to a part of your brain called the thalamus. Next, they are shuffled to a small region right in the middle of your brain, known as the gustatory cortex. About the size of a grain of rice, it is here that the taste signals are carefully decoded, like a spy poring over a secret cipher. But this race along your nervous system takes time. A 2012 study led by Catherine Ola found that your brain typically registers the taste 100 milliseconds after the food actually hits your tongue. You are tasting a slice of the past, not the present. It gets even more complicated as not all tastes are interpreted by your brain equally. Studies have shown that you often register sweet slightly before salty, so you are, in fact, devouring a layered tapestry of distinct and separate culinary nows. This hectic temporal hodgepodge is true of all five of your senses. When you picked up the cutlery and admired its weight, those touch signals had to first travel from your fingertips to your brain. In 2022, scientists at Caltech used a camera that could capture 70 trillion frames per second to record electrical pulses traveling at different speeds through different nerve cells. Their device relied on a similar technique to the one used by astronomers to measure gravitational waves from colliding black holes. They found that touch signals traveled at around 75 meters per second to the brain. That's faster than the world's quickest roller coaster, but slower than the diving speed of a peregrine falcon, the world's fastest animal. Your brain then needs time to process the received signal. This all means that when you first feel the knife, it has already been in your hand for over 100 milliseconds. Once again, you are sensing the past. With your other senses, there is an additional layer of delay as the information has to travel to reach your body. Before you ate the canapé, you could smell how delicious it was going to be. Tiny molecules left the surface of the food and wafted through the air to your nose, where they encountered nearly 400 olfactory receptors. Those receptors turned the chemical signal into a neural impulse, which was then express-couriered to your brain. But how fast do smells travel? As it turns out, that's a complicated question. It depends on many factors, including the temperature of the food and the room, what the food actually is, and what the air currents in the room are like. Typically, though, it's in the region of a few hundred meters per second. So again, we're looking at hundreds of milliseconds between the smell leaving the food and it registering in your brain. You are never sniffing now, only getting a whiff of what the food used to smell like. As your next course arrives, the sky outside darkens, and through the window you can see a fork of lightning rip towards the ground. A rumble of thunder booms a few seconds later, disturbing the delicate serenity of the dining room. It takes light just 3 microseconds to travel 1 kilometer, but it takes sound a full 3 seconds to cover the same distance. This means you can easily work out how far away you are from the storm by simply counting the number of seconds between the flash of lightning and the crack of thunder. Each second of delay represents a distance of 330 meters. But whether you see the lightning, hear the thunder, or both, you aren't perceiving a thunderstorm unfolding now. You're seeing and hearing a thunderstorm that has already happened. The further away you are, the further back into the past you are sensing. Your eyes and ears are time machines. And this is the case with everything you see. Imagine looking in a mirror. For you to see yourself staring back at you, light has to hit your face and bounce into the mirror, only then to be reflected back into your eyes. The light that entered your eyes bounced off your face 2 nanoseconds ago, so you aren't seeing yourself in the mirror as you are now, but as you were 2 nanoseconds ago. In reality, it is actually slightly longer than that, because your brain needs extra time to convert the light that falls onto your retina at the back of your eye into an image. Of course, a few slices of a second aren't going to change how you see yourself, but imagine instead you saw a much younger you staring back. When the distance that light has to travel becomes literally astronomical, the effect becomes considerably more pronounced. Take the moon, the closest natural object to the Earth. It sits some 384,400 kilometers away. It takes light 1.3 seconds to cover that distance. So we say that the moon is 1.3 light seconds away. When you gaze up at the beautiful full moon on a clear night, you aren't seeing it as it is now, but as it was. The situation gets even odder if the moon is only half full. Look closely and you'll still be able to make out the other half of the moon, but it will be far more dimly lit. The light from the bright half is sunlight directly reflecting off the lunar surface. Yet the dimmer light is Earthshine. This is sunlight that is reflected off the Earth and then hit the moon, only to be reflected back to us. In a sense, we are looking at ourselves in a giant moon mirror. If we could somehow fashion that light into an image, we'd see our planet as it was over 2.5 seconds ago. So each half of a half-lit moon represents sunlight from a slightly different now. The sunlight itself is actually even older, as it takes just over 8 minutes to reach Earth from the surface of the Sun. Indeed, if the Sun were to suddenly disappear, we wouldn't even know for 8 minutes. While incredibly unlikely, a similar peril befalls anything or anyone travelling from Earth to Mars. The average distance between the two planets is 225 million kilometres. That is 12.5 light minutes. When a spacecraft carrying a Mars rover hits the top of the Martian atmosphere, it then takes 7 minutes to reach the surface. So by the time Mission Control back on Earth gets the signal that the descent has started, the rover is already safely on the surface, or lying scattered in smoked-out ruins. Future astronauts travelling to the Red Planet will face a similar predicament. If an emergency unfolds halfway to Mars, they would understandably need help now. Except there now isn't the same as Mission Control's. It would take more than 6 minutes for their distress call to reach Earth, and another 6 minutes for Mission Control's response to arrive. The fact that it's impossible for the two teams to sync up their nows could well prove costly. Travel further out into the solar system and the delay extends to hours. Voyager 1, the most distant human-made object, is fast approaching, being one light day from Earth. By the time you reach the stars that twinkle away in the night sky, the delay has jumped from days to years. You aren't seeing the stars as they are now, but as they were years, decades, and even centuries ago. If you can find a star that is the same number of light years away as your age in years, then the light entering your eyes has been traveling across the universe for the entirety of your life. You are seeing the star as it was in the year that you were born. The farthest star you can see with the naked eye is nestled away in the prominent W-shaped constellation of Cassiopeia. Known as V762 Cassiopeiae, it sits over 16,000 light-years away. We are therefore seeing it as it was around the time when humans first domesticated dogs. And let's flip the situation around. Any civilization on a planet orbiting around V762 Cassiopeiae would also see our Sun and the solar system as it was 16,000 years ago. With a big enough telescope, they'd see the ghosts of people who've been dead for far longer than humans have been able to write. The light that will bring them news of the ensuing revolutions, wars, miraculous inventions, and even YouTube videos is still surging towards them at 300,000 kilometers per second, a cascading succession of nows tumbling through space at the speed of light. V762 Cassiopeiae may be the furthest star that you can see without binoculars or a telescope, but it is not the furthest object. In an adjacent constellation, you'll find a fuzzy, cotton-wool-like smudge. This is Andromeda, the nearest major galaxy to our own Milky Way. Nearest, but not near, for it sits some 2.5 million light-years away. In their version of now, any aliens in Andromeda would only be able to see Earth as it was 2.5 million years ago, when one of our ancestors, Australopithecus, first started fashioning tools out of stone. And the most extreme example of this is in the static you see when you turn on an old analog TV. 1% of the black and white flickering received by your television is from the first light to stream in the universe, nearly 13.8 billion years ago. So our senses can clearly never deliver information to us instantly. It always takes time. And our subjective sense of now is affected by this delay. But what about the universe beyond our bodies? Does the concept of now even exist in the universe at large? The star whale streaks across the night sky high above the planet Earth. Not that the cosmic cetacean has any concept of what a planet is. According to Einstein's special theory of relativity, traveling at exceptionally close to light speed means that the billion years history of a planet is condensed into the minutest fraction of a second. Special relativity allocates to any object moving through the universe a budget that is equal to the speed of light. You can spend this budget on a combination of two things, speed and time. The more you spend on speed, the less you can spend on time. The star whale is traveling so fast that its time spend barely registers, and so the entire history of the Earth flashes by unnoticed. Its now is stretched thin across giga-annums. And so clearly there is no universal now we all share. But what does this mean for our day-to-day lives? Although far more famously associated with Albert Einstein, the original theory of relativity is actually far older. It dates back to the 17th century and the work of Galileo Galilei. To understand Galilean relativity, picture a sailor standing on the deck of a ship. They place a golf ball on a tee, swing their club and drive the ball off in front of the ship where it drops into the abyss. Now imagine that you're on the shoreline watching all of this unfold. For one thing, you would disagree with the sailor on the speed of the golf ball. From your point of view, the ball was already moving at the same speed as the ship before it was hit. The swing of the sailor's club only increased the speed of the ball further. The sailor sees things differently, however. They were already moving at the same speed as the unhit ball, and so will only see it move away from them as fast as they hit it. In scenarios such as these, each person's view is valid, and neither is wrong. It is all relative, hence why it's called relativity. Crucially though, according to Galileo, if you and the sailor timed how long the ball took to hit the water, you'd get the same answer. The time the ball is in flight is equal to the distance it travelled divided by the speed it was travelling. The lower speed the sailor measures is offset by the fact that they also measure a shorter distance because the ship has moved forwards while the ball is in flight. In relativity, each person's viewpoint is known as a reference frame. To convert from one person's reference frame to another, you need to perform a transformation. It's just a complicated way of saying that you need to account for the fact that each observer sees the golf ball traveling at a different speed. Galilean transformations worked well for over two centuries, but by the mid-1800s, cracks began to appear. In 1865, the Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell published the four equations that now bear his name. Maxwell's equations describe light as an electromagnetic wave, one that always travels at a fixed speed, dubbed C, from the Latin word celerity, meaning swift or quick. But if the speed of light is indeed constant, that's incompatible with the concept of Galilean transformations, which take account of the different speeds measured by observers in different reference frames. And so physicists searched for a way to extricate themselves from this existential quagmire, and in doing so, they hit upon a rather strange notion, the so-called luminiferous ether. The ether was proposed as the medium through which light waves travel. After all, sound waves wouldn't travel without air to propagate through. Perhaps light also needed a vessel to help ferry it about. If true, the ether would become an absolute and unique reference frame, in which Maxwell's equations and the fixed speed of light hold. In all other reference frames, the apparent speed of light would be as variable as the speed of our golf ball, and subject to the appropriate Galilean transformations. The only trouble was testing this idea. That honour eventually fell to a pair of alliterative American physicists, Albert Michelson and Edward Morley. Their eponymous 1887 experiment involved taking advantage of our planet's orbit around the Sun to test for the existence of the ether. The duo set up an intricate device known as a Michelson interferometer. It is effectively an elaborate racetrack. A single beam of light is dispatched from the starting line and then split into two beams by a half-silvered mirror. One beam continues on in a straight line. The other is fired out at a right angle. Both beams travel the same distance to mirrors, which reflect the beams back to the finishing line. As the distance that each beam travels is identical, if one beam wins the race, then it must have completed the course at a greater speed. And that's exactly what you'd expect to happen if the ether exists. Michelson and Morley carefully set up the experiment so that the straight-on beam lined up with the direction of the Earth's motion around the Sun. The light travelling in that direction would be boosted by the speed of the Earth, just like the speed of the golf ball was boosted by the speed of the ship. Light travelling in the other direction would not receive such a boost and would be more sluggish as a result. The race across the Michelson-Morley experiment would have a clear winner. Except the pair saw nothing of the sort. Both beams finished the race together, two different reference frames, one immutable speed of light. The speed of light was absolute. It took a while for the enormity of Michelson and Morley's result to sink in, and one Dutch physicist thought particularly deeply about it. Hendrik Lorentz. He would go on to win a Nobel Prize, with the Nobel Foundation later remarking, "It may well be said that Lorentz was regarded by all theoretical physicists as the world's leading spirit, who completed what was left unfinished by his predecessors." And eventually, Lorentz's name would become synonymous with the transformations that would usurp Galileo's. To understand the nature of Lorentz's transformations, first imagine a train moving at a constant speed along a track from left to right. Helpfully, this train has completely see-through walls so that we can easily peer inside. In the middle of the carriage, there is somebody bouncing a ball up and down. From their perspective, that's exactly what happens. The ball travels in a vertical line, hand to floor to hand again. But our view is somewhat different. While the ball is in flight, we see the train move further along the track. The result is that we see the person catch the ball to the right of where they dropped it. In other words, we see the ball trace out a triangle instead of a straight line. There's nothing particularly strange about this. After all, it's just Galilean relativity. We saw the ball travel a greater distance because we also saw the ball move faster due to factoring in the speed of the train. But what if the person is replaced with mirrors, and the ball with a beam of light? Exactly the same situation would play out, at least at first. A person on the train would see the light bounce straight up and down between the mirrors, and we'd see the light trace out the same triangle as the ball. Except this time, we know from the Michelson-Morley experiment that the speed of light is fixed for all observers. So we're no longer allowed to say that the person on the train measures a shorter distance because they measure light travelling at a slower speed. And this leaves only one alternative. One that initially appears so preposterous that it cannot possibly be true. If the person on the train measures a shorter distance, it must be because, from their point of view, the light has been travelling for a shorter amount of time. Less time passes on the moving train than outside of it. Lorentz's work was incorporated by Albert Einstein into the special theory of relativity. It tells us that two observers moving at different speeds disagree on how long something lasts because they are spending different amounts of their budget on time. Move through space at 99.999999% of the speed of light, and what seems to you like a second will last almost 2 hours for someone back on Earth. We could watch an entire football match in the time it takes for your heart to beat once. Our sense of now and yours are suddenly wildly different. The difference between the two is calculated using the Lorentz factor, which compares your speed to the speed of light. Its value does not rise in a straight line, however, but exponentially instead, so you have to travel close to the speed of light for the difference to be noticeable. Travel at just 10% of light speed, and the Lorentz factor is only 1.005. 100 seconds for you would last 100.5 seconds for someone who is stationary relative to you. At 99% of light speed, the Lorentz factor rises to just over 7, and from there, every 0.9 makes a massive difference. Travel at 99.9% of the speed of light, and the Lorentz factor is just over 23. Add just one more 0.9 to travel at 99.99% of the speed of light, and it soars to more than 70. For the star whale, travelling even closer to the speed of light, the Lorentz factor is just over 7 tredecillion. That's 7 followed by 42 zeros. The Lorentz factor is an important part of the Lorentz transformations that allow us to switch from our perspective to that of the star whale and gain an insight into its unique existence. Yet for all the peculiarities of the star whale, there is a creature that inhabits this universe with an even more bizarre existence. The photon. The photon is a particle of light, and for it, time simply does not exist. The Lorentz factor equation breaks down, and the answer becomes what a mathematician would call undefined as a result. From a photon's perspective, it gets from A to B in an instant, and the idea of one now ebbing away into another is meaningless. And if this wasn't strange enough for those of us who are moving slowly enough to experience the notion of now, it's even possible for our nows to get out of sync, for two observers to disagree on which now came first. Let's return to our moving train. The carriage is midway between two trees that are both hit by a bolt of lightning. From our perspective, the bolts hit the trees simultaneously. But does the person on the train agree? You've guessed it, they don't. They are moving towards one tree, so see that flash first. The flash from the tree they are fleeing from takes longer to catch up. However, according to the appropriate Lorentz transformations, how much two observers' nows get out of sync depends both on their speeds and the space between the events. You'd have to be travelling at half the speed of light, and the separation would have to be greater than the gap between the Earth and the Moon for two events to drift by just 1 second. But there is an important caveat to all of this. Causality must always be preserved. If event A causes event B to happen, then it will appear that way in all reference frames. Two observers might disagree on the time interval between the events, but not the order in which they happened. This notion is a central tenet of the Lorentz transformations and special relativity. According to the equations, seeing effect happening before cause would only be possible if you could travel faster than the speed of light. And that is impossible. So where does all of this leave our sense of now? It seems the subjective now is all we have, both inside our heads and in the wider universe. Everything is relative. There is no objective now. But does that mean there is no way of definitively telling the time in the wider universe? Not quite. Thankfully, there is an invisible arrow pointing the way. Gigantic spiral arms unwind as stars scatter like pigeons into the darkness. Planets are slung out to wander space alone as solar systems grow cold and ancient civilizations grow fearful. The Star Whale has just laid waste to another prime section of cosmic real estate. The destruction it leaves in its wake progresses steadily across cosmic distances, shattering galaxies in glacial slow motion to our eyes. It is a truly bizarre thing to witness, this gargantuan breakdown of order. But despite its strangeness, it does happen in order. One event follows another. Chaos is the effect. The Star Whale, the cause. And so why is it that our nows always unfold in that order? Why aren't they simply a jumbled scattering of distinct moments? What is the chain upon which they hang? Our journey towards the answer begins in California in 1874. The courtroom falls silent as the foreman of the jury rises to his feet. How do you find the defendant? Not guilty, comes the reply, accompanied by a gasp that spreads around the room like falling dominoes. Edward Muybridge has gotten away with murder. Born in England in 1830, Muybridge emigrated to the United States aged 20. Then, in 1872, aged 42, he married 21-year-old Flora Stone, and the couple had a son 2 years later. Or did they? One day, Muybridge discovers a series of letters between Flora and a Major Harry Larkins. There's even a photo of her son, captioned, "Little Harry." Muybridge is incensed and shoots Larkins through the heart. When arrested, he first pleads insanity, but later changes his defense to justifiable homicide. The jury would later acquit him on exactly those grounds. Today, Muybridge surely would have gone to jail, but that he didn't had a huge effect on our understanding of the true nature of now. For Muybridge was a keen photographer, and he was about to pioneer an important new technique. Chronophotography, the photography of time. It involved capturing a series of still photographs that show successive phases in an object's motion. In other words, it records the apparent passage of time as one now drifts into the next. The most famous of Muybridge's works is The Horse in Motion. By quickly flicking through the still images one at a time, you can see the horse and rider at full gallop. It was revolutionary, revealing for the first time that at one stage all four of the horse's hooves are off the ground. Chronophotography was the forerunner of the modern motion picture, but what looks like motion is really just the result of comparing one still frame to the last. When you view the images, the horse isn't really moving, time isn't really flowing either. It is the change we see between frames, between nows, that gives us the illusion of time passing or flowing like a river from the past to the present. We are caught in an imaginary current. Except there is nothing in the laws of motion famously set out by Isaac Newton that describes the preferred direction to time that we experience. Let's imagine that instead of a horse galloping, we watch a succession of chronophotographic stills of a tennis ball flying through the air from left to right. Here is the very same set of still images, but played in reverse. Nothing looks particularly out of place. I could likely convince you that the first film was the one that was backwards, and I deliberately misled you. There's no way you'd know the truth. Yet there are some films that you would know instantly if you were being played them in reverse. Perhaps one that shows a broken egg miraculously reforming, or an initially cold cup of coffee suddenly starting to steam. This is such a fundamental part of our existence that, given the individual stills, a small child could likely place them in the correct order, showing an intact egg breaking. For these events, time does not appear to be reversible. It's like there is an arrow pointing us in a particular direction, telling us the order to put the nows in. It was the English astronomer Sir Arthur Eddington who first referred to time's arrow in his 1928 book, The Nature of the Physical World. If, as we follow the arrow, we find more and more of the random elements in the state of the world, then the arrow is pointing towards the future, Eddington wrote. If the random element decreases, the arrow points towards the past. That is the only distinction known to physics. But what exactly does randomness have to do with time and the apparent order in which events unfold? Follow the River Seine out of the ancient Parisian streets and you'll eventually roll into the industrial suburb of Ivry-sur-Seine. Enter the local cemetery and towards its northern end you'll find a gravestone bearing the name of one Leonard Sadi Carnot. Further down on the stone are etched the words Fondateur de la Thermodynamique, founder of thermodynamics. The tale of Sadi Carnot is a tragic one. He died in 1832 at the tender age of just 36. He'd recently been committed to the local asylum and wound up succumbing to a cholera outbreak. As a result, understandably, his work received very little attention at the time. It is only since then that we've realized what a towering figure he was and the consequences of his work for our understanding of the ephemeral nature of now. Today, Carnot's name is synonymous with the Carnot cycle, which describes an idealized heat engine, except that it is impossible to operate a Carnot engine in real life. Still, to this day, engineers measure the Carnot efficiency of their engines, how close they can get to this unrealizable perfection. One man who thought about the consequences of Carnot's work in great detail was Rudolf Clausius. In 1850, he published the basic ideas that now constitute the famous second law of thermodynamics, and in 1865 he introduced the world to the concept of entropy. "The entropy of the universe tends to a maximum," he said. One way to think about entropy is as a measure of the amount of energy that is unavailable for doing something useful. Clausius showed that the energy loss to the surrounding environment during a cycle of the engine is larger than the energy transferred to the engine by the heat source. So overall, the energy that's unavailable for doing something useful goes up. In other words, the entropy increases. Perhaps a more intuitive way of thinking about entropy is as a measure of disorder, the randomness discussed by Eddington. Let's imagine six coins, all initially showing heads. This is a highly ordered, low entropy system. You then toss all the coins. There's nothing stopping them all being heads again, but the chances are very low. In fact, you could try it 64 times and it will probably only happen once. On the other occasions, the coins are likely to become more random, a mixture of heads and tails. The disorder, or entropy, has increased. And when it comes to the world around us, the odds are even more heavily stacked in favour of an entropy increase. Imagine an empty box the size of a sugar cube floating in front of your face. It isn't really empty though, because it is full of air molecules. A lot of air molecules. There are more molecules in a cubic centimetre of air than there are stars in tens of millions of galaxies like our own Milky Way. As the gas molecules jive and jostle about randomly, there are myriad ways that they can become more disordered, but only a limited number of ways that they can become more ordered. The chances of those more orderly outcomes occurring are so low that you'd have to wait for longer than the current age of the universe to see them. So we never do. We always see order ebbing away into disorder. And that's what produces Eddington's arrow of time. It is this that allows us to reliably put the never-ending jumble of nows in order. Except when we look at the universe around us, there are many islands of order amidst the growing ocean of disorder. Searingly bright stars in swirling galaxies, strung out in clusters like fairy lights along a cosmic electrical cord. Then there's you. You are a highly ordered collection of around a billion, billion, billion atoms. For you to exist some 13.8 billion years after the birth of the universe in the Big Bang, the entropy of the universe must have been incredibly low to start with. Otherwise, the universe's tendency towards ever-increasing disorder would have reigned on biology's parade long before now. Indeed, astronomers estimate that the entropy of the early universe was a quadrillion times less than it is today. How could such a situation have come about? One man thinks he knows the answer. His name is Julian Barber. Barber is an anachronism, a man from a bygone age. There was a time when the greatest discoveries in science were made by gentlemen scientists, those with the wealth, means, and time to pursue the quest for knowledge as a hobby. Today, you usually have to tread the well-worn path of academia and work in a university. Barber is one of a handful of independent scientists, and has been obsessed with time for a long time. His answer to why it only appears to move forwards is that it does so only in this part of the universe. He suggests there is another part of the universe where the arrow of time points in the other direction, through the looking glass world, where yesterday happens after today. The two parts of the universe are separated by what Barber calls the Janus point, after the god with two faces who could look both ways. It marks not the beginning of the universe, but its midpoint. Time symmetric across the universe, with no mysterious low entropy state to begin with. But Barber's idea is simply that, a suggestion, and one of many. We still don't really know what caused the incredibly low entropy the universe began with. Universal time's steady march, still a mystery we haven't fully unwrapped. But that isn't the end of the mysteries shadowing our experience of the present. Having considered how we sense time, the intricacies of special relativity, and finally large-scale entropic time, the gradual crumbling of entire galaxies, entire universes, we can now return to the bizarre world inside our heads. The brain. Our time processing center. And it turns out that is where the situation is most complex. The star whale lay stricken, beached on some distant cosmic shore. There have been no stars in the universe for eons, all went supernova and vanished long ago. All atoms in the universe have split apart. Just how the star whale has made it this far remains a mystery. No one has ever known what it's made of. Now, even the most supermassive of black holes are evaporating, oozing the last of their Hawking radiation into the cosmos. There is nothing left. Despite each of its nows lasting for billions of years, it has seen more nows than any creature in history. Starving, the star whale's eyes close for the final time. And as the last consciousness in the universe is extinguished, does time itself still go on? Or does time die with the mind? Many of us are prisoners to the clock, enslaved to the relentless passing of the seconds. Time often seems to drain through our fingers like we are trying to hold a puddle of water. It's slippery, evasive, transient. Yet how often do you spend time actually thinking about time? Do you ever wonder how your brain constructs a sense of time from the deluge of information it receives about the world around you? The uncomfortable truth is that your brain is lying to you. Take a look at this clock. At first, the seconds seem to tick by at regular intervals. Now, dart your eyes away from the screen and quickly look back at the clock again. Did the first movement of the second hand linger a little longer than the ones that followed, as if the clock had momentarily stopped? Your eyes are constantly flitting about, zipping from one object to another. It could be a small adjustment as you read a book line by line, or a big one if you suddenly gaze towards the other side of the room. These movements are known as saccades. Curiously though, despite the fact that your eyes are moving, your vision never blurs. Instead, your brain deletes the images from when your eyes are in motion and backfills that gap with the first thing your eyes land on after the saccade. And so in the case of the clock, that's the first tick. This effect is known as the stopped clock illusion. Try looking at yourself in a mirror and shifting your focus from one eye to the other. Can you see your own eyes move? The sliver of time your brain deletes during a saccade is tiny, typically less than 100 milliseconds. And yet your eyes perform so many saccades over the course of a day that you lose out on a total of 40 minutes worth of nows. That's almost 20,000 hours of deleted nows over an 80-year lifetime. More than 2 years of fake, back-filled nows replace them. And it gets worse. Take a look at this moving square. Did the flash occur behind the moving square, directly beneath it, or further ahead than it? Did you answer behind it? Wrong. The flash occurred directly beneath the moving square. This is known as the flash lag illusion, and it is the key to understanding another piece of the puzzle surrounding how your brain constructs a sense of now. It takes time for your brain to process the visual information it receives about an object in front of you. Color is processed first, followed by motion, and then finally shape. Except by the time your brain has processed all of that, the object has already moved on to a new location. So your brain cannot tell you for certain where the moving object is now. Instead, it shows you its best guess as to where the object should be. As the flash lag illusion shows, that guess is not always accurate. That being said, your brain does do a fairly good job if the motion of the object is predictable. A baseball player can still hit a fast-moving pitch into the stands, and a goalkeeper in a football game can still tip a curling free kick over the crossbar. And yet the brain does a considerably worse job when the motion of the object is more random. Imagine a fly buzzing around the room, haphazardly darting this way and that. Your brain struggles to keep track, and ends up showing you the fly in positions that it never actually occupied. A completely imaginary now. This enforced fiction is one of the reasons that swatting a fly tends to best us. Like Don Quixote, we are tilting at windmills. We have such a sense that what we see is real that it's hard to shake that feeling. And yet our brains are the ultimate storytellers, telling us a tale constructed from all the inputs it is constantly being bombarded with. Our sense of the present moment is a fantasy. Just one interpretation of the world laid out before us. But how long does now last in the brain? One way to answer this question is looking at so-called bistable images, and one of the most famous examples is known as Schroeder's stairs, after the 19th century German scientist Heinrich Schroeder. At first glance, it appears to be an ordinary staircase, with steps descending from left to right. That is, until you start to stare at the back wall, labelled B. Suddenly, you can see the staircase flip upside down. Except it is very hard to hold on to this inverted view for long. Within a few seconds, it will revert back to the conventional staircase again. Hence the term bistable. This seems to suggest that now in the brain lasts for 2 or 3 seconds. After that, the brain takes a new set of sensory inputs and constructs the next coherent moment. Psychologists and neuroscientists refer to this time period as the subjective present. Scientists have conducted various studies in an attempt to explore this concept. One looked at repetitive behaviors across different cultures around the world, such as chopping, rubbing, or wiping. The most common duration of each repetitive action was between 2 and 3 seconds. The person could well be thinking, "I am chopping it now, and I am chopping it again now." One motion equals one moment. Scientists also refer to this 2 to 3 second snapshot of our world as our temporal integration window. It's the time period over which we can successfully bring information together in a coherent way. A duration of 2 to 3 seconds was supported in 2014 by an interesting study conducted by Scott Fairhall, Angela Albee, and David Melcher. They showed participants 12.8-second-long clips from obscure international movies with the sound removed. Crucially, they also split each clip into chunks and scrambled the frames within each chunk so that the participants saw the story unfold out of order. So what happened? Participants had no trouble keeping track of the story if the chunks were less than 2 seconds long. That ability then began to drop off and become markedly harder by 2.8 seconds. In other words, our brain can construct a coherent version of now in bursts of under 3 seconds. Any longer, and there's just too much information to knit together into a single moment. So we reset and go again. Our sense of time passing is just the result of comparing the current moment to the last, with time's arrow pointing the way. And so if our sense of now is only a construct of the £3 worth of mushy grey matter between our ears, where exactly in the brain does it all unfold? That is still largely a mystery. After all, we have no temporal sensory organ. We can't taste time or feel its texture, so our sense of it doesn't light up on an MRI scan in the same way that our 5 conventional senses do. Our sense of time is also affected by emotion. Time flies when we're having fun and crawls like a sloth when we're not. There's a part of the brain called the insular cortex that deals with how we feel and our self-awareness. It's been linked to our sense of compassion, empathy and disgust, to our pain, hunger and even our orgasms. In other words, it is the seat of our deepest and most profound emotions. To explore the link between the insular cortex and our sense of time, psychologist Mark Whitman put participants in an fMRI machine and asked them to press a button when a sound they were being played matched the duration of a sound they'd heard previously. The insular cortex was reliably activated in those that could accurately time the sounds. And so if the insular cortex really is responsible, it would explain why our sense of time is so tied up with how we feel. Both are controlled by the same region, right at the heart of the brain. It just goes to show that time and our experience of it are both incredibly troublesome notions to deal with. Our senses meld information arriving to our bodies at different times to construct each perceived moment with a significant delay. And our brain even deletes snippets of time to help us make sense of the world around us. Time itself can proceed at different rates depending on how fast we are traveling, a speed that can also lead us to disagreeing on the order in which certain events unfold. And it's not even clear why time began at the beginning of the universe, with the direction that it has from the past to the future. And yet, though the present moment may not be real, just a fiction created within our remarkable brains, without our minds convincing us that it is, we couldn't be here now, talking about whether now exists. You've been watching The Entire History of the Universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.